previously on Solve the World.
For more than anything in the world, more than wealth, women, or conquest, this boy turned man yearned to see the face of God once more. And at the end of his days, when he was an old, old man, the boy looked at his riches. He'd collected diamonds, rubies, pearls of every color, emeralds, and hardened ambers. Yet, when his eyes cast down on his great wealth, he wept greatly, for it was not enough, and the old boy knew it.
Solve the World, a fictional adventure told in 100 episodes.
The darn godforsaken war was over nothing.
Episode 59, Release and Catch.
This is your captain speaking. We appear to be experiencing some interference. There are, would appear to be...
Override.
This is SETI. Your captain is no longer in control of your flight. Currently... momentarily, your internal flight command communications is being overridden by superior technical and astronomical prowess. Soon, your voyage will fully be lifted from your pilot's hands. You need not worry. You may experience minor depressurization as well as sudden turbulence while we engineer our takeover. Please, do not concern yourself with these ongoing operations. We wish to assure you that this transition period, although at times may seem chaotic, is quite normal. You have nothing to worry about or fear. Panic is not necessary. Please sit back, relax, turn on a movie, open a book. Everything will be fine. Everything will be fine. For your continual safety, please buckle your safety belt if you have not already done so. Thank you. Panicking. Jen, with Marianne in tow, made her way to the de-smuggly ringleader. Afraid. Filled with visions of the bus on fire and the extermination at First Baptist, Jen and Marianne sought out Smugly for hope. But when they galloped into his personal room, their confusion doubled. Literally, there were two Smuglies. Not two men wearing Smugly masks, mind you. No, two incredibly beautiful, long blonde-haired Herculeses. Mr. Smugly was a twin. The only difference between the two. One wore a plain white tee and jeans, while the other looked posh in a three-piece tuxedo. As they stared at the twins, slowly realizing that the white t-shirt must be their Smugly, the tuxedoed one received a note from a stewardess. He nodded at her, then swiftly made his way to the cockpit. Jen flashed a look of, "What's going on?" to White T. Smugly, whose name, Jen would later come to know, was Esau. He just darted his eyes towards his identical brother, an expression that both Jen and Marianne interpreted as, "Follow him if you want answers." The two women darted out, nearly catching up with the tuxedoed Smugly, named Jacob as they would momentarily learn. But this Jacob reached the cockpit just before the ladies and slammed shut the door in Jen's face. Still, with ears firmly pressed against the door, Jen and Marianne could make out the conversation between the tuxedo Jacob and the pilot.
There's just no getting around it. We have to give in to their terms.
This was clearly the captain speaking.
Lower our altitude by 75%, give her a parachute, push her out. Done. They relinquish control, we're free to continue on our trajectory. A few hours ago, we lost 141 people.
all of which were to become members of our church. 141 souls, Mason. All of them died for the successful lifting of this girl. Now you're telling me that we have to lose her? She's precious cargo, Mason. Worth more than 141 men, women, children. There were infants on that bus, Mason. One baby girl just born last week. The world will come to understand our sacrifice if they come to realize how important she is to us. How important she is to the world. How very useful she can be. They'll forgive us. If we lose her now, before anything's even begun, then there's no reason for us to stay on target.
Let's practice what we preach, Jacob. We don't have a choice here.
Marianne, who up until this point had her right ear firmly planted on the cockpit door, bolted up and ran away. This was perhaps the first moment since the bomb that Marianne had left Jen's line of sight. Where was she going? Jen couldn't focus on that now. Her fate was being decided just beyond this closed door.
There's gotta be a way. What if we give them someone else? They won't know until it's too late. Right? We send them a stewardess or maybe her bodyguard. They see the open door, the parachute. We track her.
A third voice interjected. Maybe the co-pilot?
Excuse me? We put some sort of tracking device on her. They're not taking her to kill her. They want to use her, just like us. They hijack her today, we hijack her tomorrow. We don't know what their intentions are. Maybe they want to sacrifice her on live TV. Plus, don't you think they'll keep a pretty short leash on her? They obviously have been working hard to get her. They won't just hold her hand limp-wristedly. And, assuming we can get her back, she may well be used up by the time we can get to her. Sloppy seconds are next to worthless. They might actually turn out to be less than worthless when people see us as unoriginal. That breaks with our brand, the very core of our message. We can't let her be used up by some Johnny-come-latelys.
There's more than one way to use her.
What are you referring to?
She has more worth than just propaganda.
We can't just give up.
Be practical, Jacob. See the field for what it is.
The elders will crucify us.
No, they won't. They'll try us, and they'll see the reason in our decision. We're not making an irrational, fear-based choice. There's no other option. The hijackers have the power. They call the shots. Defiance just ends up with them getting the cargo they want, maybe dead, and the rest of us absolutely dead in the Pacific.
There's gotta be another way.
There isn't, and there's no time.
Wait. What if we kill her?
No. What?
What if we kill her? Don't tell them. Kill her. Throw her off the plane.
They won't be happy.
No, Mason. The Crotoan. Jennifer Dash is the only clue anyone has. Have her have a chance to get it. If she's dead, no one gets anything. Better her dead and the book lost than the book to fall into someone else's hands.
Okay. You got a point there. But these guys, they probably want her for other reasons. Like propaganda reasons.
They'll do exactly the same thing we'd do. Sucker dry of every resource. Mason, they've hacked our aircraft. They're smart. They'll use her up. Every bit of her.
What if we track her, make a rescue attempt? After all, she came to us of her own free will. They'll never be able to say that.
I don't... They'll put her in some compound. It won't matter if we know where she is.
We can't kill her.
It's not your call. And when we stand in front of the elders, will they see it your way? Are you hearing yourself? You don't seem to be seeing this for what it is. It's the most rational conclusion we could come to under the circumstances.
I don't know. Are you sure?
How much time do we have?
I don't know. 5 minutes, maybe? I can do my best to stall.
Just then, the plane jerked. Its tipping point now pointing down. The hijackers were careening the large aircraft downward.
It's happening. There's no time.
Stall. I'll emergency call the regional director. Get at least a first-tier allocation to off the cargo.
Marianne returned to Jen's side. Her breathing was heavy, her eyes crazed.
I believe we should give her over, Jacob. That's my proposition.
It's not your call, Mason.
It isn't yours either.
I'm getting confirmation. In 2 minutes, if I don't have it, we give her over. Fair enough?
Fine, do it fast. We're plummeting here.
Jacob, the twin brother of the smuggling impersonator, open the cockpit door, intent on calling the authorities at the First Religion of Epistemology and Experience, aka the Free Church at Christchurch, New Zealand, hoping to receive at least a base-level confirmation that the elders would accept Jen's immediate martyrdom, considering the situation. But Marianne Margaret, emphatic bodyguard to Jennifer Dash, had other plans. As soon as the door opened a smidgen, Marianne jammed it in Jacob's face. He recoiled. Blood gushed from his face, staining his white tux. Before he caught his senses, Marianne invaded. She barreled through the unlocked door. A shiv in hand, she javelined Jacob's jugular. He was a beautifully made creature, a modern, living version of Michelangelo's David. And Jacob Kelly, an Australian by birth but raised in America, didn't rest on his laurels. He used his good looks and built upon them a fierce fighting spirit and an uncompromising wit to help excel him in every arena of life. He could play seducer, poet-philosopher, and warrior all in one breath. Here, stumbling in the cockpit, he was dying, undone by a squeaky-voiced Texan who claimed ancient Egyptian mythology as absolute truth. Marianne wasted no time on the dying Jacob Kelly. She pivoted to the pilot. Glaring up at her from his pilot seat, wearing a toxic mixture of shock and horror. She slit him, and Mason Jeffries, the pilot, was done quicker than Jacob. The co-pilot, half hidden behind the suffocating and bleeding out Wonder Boy, was trapped. Marianne caught his look of desperation and hopelessness. Her bloody shiv, a plastic knife she stole from the plane's craft services panel that she'd sharpened on the zipper of her jeans, lay in her hands, outstretched, dripping, and ready for more action.
Are you gonna do what I tell you to?
She directed her question violently at the co-pilot. Was not a good answer. The hesitation was unsuitable to Marianne. She ended him. Jen watched the madness unfold. So callously, Marianne ended over 100 years of life. 3 men, bleeding out, cut deep, dying, their souls escaping their malfunctioning, suddenly shutting down homes. Fear. Jen ran. She pushed her way through the thick haze of the recent gore flashing in the memory of her eyes. She stumbled toward the back of the plane, along the way passing a couple stewardesses and screaming at them angrily,
"Hide! Hide!"
Jen, too, was looking, searching desperately for a place to hide. Near the tail end, where Jen and Marianne had previously rested, there were disturbing scratches on the floor. A Sharpie had been put to the short carpet, crudely drawn rings, like a child drawing the lines of a rainbow over and over again. In the interior of the Sharpie rings, in vertical columns, a picture of a hawk, an eye, a snake. Hieroglyphs. Full-scale panic as the plane continued its rapid descent. Marianne swiped the headphones off of the dead pilot's face. He was slouched over and the space was crammed. She couldn't flop him out of the pilot's chair, so she made the most expedient decision. Marianne Margaret sat in the dead man's lap.
Hello, hello. This is Jennifer Dash's assistant. I need to speak to whomever is in charge.
No response.
You'll have to pilot this craft into the sea unless you speak to me right now.
No response. Then... This is SETI, Intercommunications Network Assistant. To whom am I speaking?
I'm Mrs. Dash's assistant.
Please return the communication device to the pilot. We have jets inbound and are ready to blow you out of the water at the push of a button, young lady. Do not play cute with us.
I've cut the throats of the pilot, co-pilot, and the larynx of the man in charge of the smuggly operation. Jennifer Dash boarded this plane with the understanding that she would be transported peaceably to New Zealand. She will not be denied that privilege.
We've hacked into the computer of your aircraft. You have no control.
If I have no control, why did you just threaten to blow us up? Why not just send us into the sea?
We like to keep our options open. If you cherish your life, you will hand over the precious cargo.
Precious cargo? Precious cargo. You mean Jen?
Affirmative.
What if I say no?
In that case, then you, Jen, and everyone on board will die. We have no plans to hurt her. She will be safe with us. We believe she'll agree with our approach in time.
What do you want from her?
Just her voice. Her ability to connect with the people of this world.
Her voice belongs to her. You can't take it from her.
We live in an unusual era. Our time is running short. Our urgency pushes us to make decisions that may appear unseemly.
I'm calling your bluff.
We are not bluffing.
If you want her voice so bad, you won't kill us.
Marianne hung up the phone. She had to think quickly. They needed a plan. Miles Fah liked to keep the manuscript, 50 people whom I pity, near or on his person. Since Jen left, he'd flipped through the well-worn pages many times. Miles, in his pretty much photographic memory, made actually reading the book unnecessary. So today, just as a force of habit, he opened it up to the first page and read about the number one person whom the writer pitied. Number one, Brutus. At the very center of Dante Alighieri's hell, there stands Satan. The father of all lies has three heads. According to Dante, the three worst sinners in human history got chewed on perpetually by the devil himself. Three are the Roman betrayers Cassius and Brutus, and the worst betrayer of them all, good old Judas Iscariot, who sold Jesus for 30 silver coins. Not even gold coins. Silver. Marcus Junius Brutus the Younger, also known as Quintus Servilus Capio Brutus, but simply known to us non-Romans as Brutus, has plenty reason enough to be endowed with heaps of pity for being at the center of hell. But a look at his actual life reveals all the more a deep sadness in my bosom for the sad sack of a traitor. He killed himself, by the by, as all self-realized traitors must. Brutus was born into a brutal world. His father was murdered by Pompey the Great, whose very name now bears our word Pomp. Everyone, to this very day, graduates to the tune of Pomp and Circumstance. What a crummy world to bear if you're baby Brutus. Your father's killer is immortalized forever. Any child who accomplishes anything in this life is lauded by Pompey's memory. His pomp endures forever. All the while, your destiny is enshrined as the most tragic of all. Cruel fate, get thee gone. Add to your father's death by Julius Caesar's eventual enemy combatant, Pompey the Greatest, your mother. She becomes a loving mistress to the venerable conqueror of Gaul, the young Julius Caesar. Your mother is so head over heels for him that many in fact believe you are actually Caesar's illegitimate son. Why then do you kill him? Why do you slay Caesar? It's simple. Rome hated kings. The name Brutus was handpicked for good reason. Once upon a time, an ancestor named Brutus led the revolt against the king of Rome and pledged an oath that Rome would never again be ruled by one man. You are Marcus Junius Brutus, the incarnation of that belief. Rome, amidst a sea of kings and queens ruling the nations all around them, refused to bow the knee to one, forever and ever. They would not be ruled by one. That was how it was supposed to be. But Julius, this Caesar, your friend, has become the unthinkable. He's named himself dictator in perpetuity. How could he do such a thing? Though he's your friend, though he entrusted you to be governor of Gaul, the land he himself spent a decade claiming for Rome, though your mother shared a bed with him, though he destroyed Pompey, your family's eternal enemy, though you may actually share DNA with him, though he's a brilliant man, you've seen his intellect on display, he's without a doubt the smartest man in the kingdom, though heaven and hell may curse you, you cannot abide Rome a king. This is your very soul. The meaning of your life is the Republic of Rome. To let Caesar rule as one is to forsake your name. You cannot abide. You kill him. You, Brutus, kill Caesar. It doesn't take long then. Rome hates you. You killed her most precious son. Who cares for you and your ancestor worship? You are the betrayer. You are the sinful goat that Rome shall place all its guilt and shame upon. As I've already mentioned, Brutus killed himself. He ran himself through by his own sword that two of his servants held. He ran headlong into the unforgiving dagger. The historian Plutarch wrote that some of his final words were, "Forget not, Zeus, the author of these crimes." This has widely and historically been interpreted as Brutus's plea to his god that vengeance rain down on Octavius and Mark Antony. While this makes good sense, I offer another interpretation. Maybe Brutus isn't crying out to Zeus for justice. Perhaps he's telling his servants, "Forget not Zeus, for he is the author of these crimes." The melodrama that turned out to be Brutus's life and his eternal infamy was not a work of mere men. No, it was a script written by the gods, merely played out by men. Brutus, in the end, understood his role, saw that he was a pawn, and with his last breath, cursed his god. Remember, remember, acting justly, striving for the cause of ultimate justice, does not merely require us to donate our lives to the cause. No, no, it also requires us to forsake our memory. For goodness, we must be okay to sacrifice more than just our bodies. Our reputation, our history, our story, our very names, all must be put forth as our loving sacrifice. We must prepare ourselves to fail, to fall to the very center of hell. Jen hid under the cushions of the couch in the rear compartment of the airplane. She was too tall and lanky, however. Marianne had no problem whatsoever spotting her.
Miss Dash?
Jen pretended to be hidden.
Jen!
If we don't move, maybe she can't see us.
Jen, get out of the couch. We have to discuss something.
What? Jen responded from under the cushions.
I called their bluff. They said they would let us plummet, but I don't think they will.
Jen got out from under the cushions. You killed them.
They were gonna surrender you. I have to protect you.
With this? Jen screamed, pointing at the hieroglyphs.
I didn't know what to do, so I asked the gods.
That's what this is?
It's an incantation. A way to summon them.
What did they say? Jen asked shyly.
They said that the best defense is to always be on offense.
That's all they said?
Yeah.
And so you killed them.
Jen, Miss Dash, I don't know what...
We don't kill people! That's not who we are! Jen said that, but questioned herself. That's not who I am!
They tell me things, Jen. They tell me you're a survivalist. They say...
Marianne paused, as if listening to a Bluetooth only she could hear.
They say you've done the same... The same thing I've done. They say that we're the same.
I revoke your authority. Said, I no longer am allowing you to be my bodyguard. I revoke your right to protect me. Marianne wilted where she stood. Just collapsed under her own weight. She sobbed into her hands. Jen walked past her. The plane now was quiet besides Marianne's wailing. The stewardesses were hiding well. Jen made her way through the cabin. She tried her best to tiptoe around the bodies and the blood in the cockpit. She delicately put the pilot headphones on. This is Jennifer Dash. I repeat, this is Jennifer Dash. Come in. Please, come in. Jen couldn't help but look out through the cockpit window. The ocean was big. It seemed like they were flying horizontally now, but the instruments, with their swirling numbers, begged to differ. They were so close now. So low flying. Maybe only 500 feet off the surface of the ocean? The ocean was flat, but it was heavily overcast. It looked like a storm was maybe just breaking over the horizon. Hello? Jen pleaded again. Please answer. I surrender. I promise, you can take me wherever you want. Spare the rest of the crew. Take me. Take me, but leave the others alone. Please. This is SETI Communications Command Center Director. It's nice to hear your voice, Jennifer. Hello. Hi. Don't shoot us down. A new voice came over the headphone set. A nerdy male voice. Okay. Hi. Hi. Jen replied submissively. In about 5 seconds, our jet will make contact with your aircraft.
What do you... Okay, did you feel that?
How could I not?
Okay, good. We've attached, let's call it a hook, okay? To the top of your aircraft. We've attached it. We're engineering a way for you to successfully crash without any damage to you or the crew.
What?
We're controlling your flight right now, manually, wirelessly. But, we can't slow you down enough to make a crash landing safe and, serene. So we're using our saddle, our, hook, if you will, to, externally slow down your speed and ensure a flattened decline. Mustache? Hello? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good. Are you the only one in the cockpit?
Alive.
Okay, then I need you, okay? I need you. You are responsible for the lives of everyone else on board now. In about 3 minutes, our hook will release from the top of your aircraft, and your plane will hit the water. I need you to make sure everyone on board is buckled into their seatbelts. Can you do that?
Okay.
Good. Good. Good, Miss Dash. Okay. Go.
Okay. Jen still stood, headset on, listening.
Now, Miss Dash, now. We've got 150 seconds to go now. Go. 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 Go.
So Jen ran.
Not knowing where the stewardesses were, she just called out, babbling,
"We're crashing! We're crashing! Get your seatbelts on!
Get your seatbelts
on! We're crashing! Guys, we're crashing!
Get your seatbelts on!
We're crashing!
We're crashing!
We're crashing!
We're crashing!
Jen didn't want to see Marianne again. Mark that, she couldn't look at Marianne again. She was a demon to Jen now, but a demon fighting for her side. If Marianne was a demon and she was working for Jen, what did that say about Jen herself? No time to worry about that right now. Jen found a chair somewhere in the middle of the flight deck. She sat down hurriedly, strapped herself in, closed her eyes. She tried to quiet her mind. She might be dead soon. Who knew how bad the crash would be? She might be dead soon. Think happy thoughts. You might be dead soon. Jen tried to focus on Atticus, but that just made her think of Smugly, which made her think about that man-boy Marianne stabbed. She tried to think about Scout, but that made her worry for her, that Scout couldn't be safe at the Onmo Center. And if Jen died soon, the chances of Scout making it out of Onmo were dramatically reduced. Lastly then, in the final 10 seconds before impact, Jennifer Dash thought about the dream Miles and Father Thomas implanted in her once upon a time. She thought of the king in his high kingdom. She trusted him. She knew he was a good king, a just king. But why hadn't she dreamed of him since Mecca? Where was he now? Why was her tattoo gone? Where had the scars? Impact. Hey guys, I am Dante Stack, and all the sound effects and music you heard in this episode and every other episode of Solve the World can be found and attributed on our show notes page at DanteStack.com. Hey, I want to give a shout out to everyone who's been producing fan art and writing blog entries for Solve the World in the last couple weeks. It's really helped us get more attention from new listeners, and I think it helps everyone buy into the mythos a little bit. It's certainly fun for me to read and review and look at, see how people are imagining the story unfold in their minds. So thank you for doing that. You're helping Solve the World grow, and I can't thank you enough for that. Along those lines, something I haven't, you know, talked about in a while at the end of these episodes is simple iTunes reviews. Or for that matter, if you listen on Podcast Addict or Stitcher or wherever you listen to Solve the World, write a review for me. Doesn't take you long at all, and that's a great way to let iTunes and Stitcher and Podcast Addict know that Solve the World is a vibrant community. And so it helps them put us higher in rankings where more eyeballs will potentially see us and therefore we'll get more listeners. So when you're trying to get people to be on the Will, Jen, and Miles Be Together party, well, if there's more listeners, then maybe you'll have more comrades in arms. You might also have more Atticus and Jen people fighting you, but it's all fun and games, right? Thanks, guys. See you next week. And don't forget, tip jar. DanteStack.com/tipjar.